I jokingly consider Indiana University's Dr. George Sledge and Dr. Kathy Miller as the Batman and Robin of breast cancer oncology, and these two champions of clinical research, who are frequent guests on our series, have had a particularly key role in the evolution of anti-angiogenic therapy. I'm like many baby boomer oncologists in that my med school preparation for intracellular biology seems primitive today, and I'm like other oncologists struggling to understand the increasingly complex mechanisms of action of newer targeted agents, including monoclonal antibodies and small molecule tyrosine kinase inhibitors, but I always like to take a shot at updating this weary brain on what has become highly clinically relevant basic science. I met with Dr. Miller to query her about perhaps the most encouraging research report on anti-angiogenic therapy, specifically ECOG Trial 2100 that she initially reported at the 2005 ASCO meeting. However, I began our conversation by cautiously requesting that Dr. Miller do a brief Angiogenesis 101 update, and she began by talking about the mysteries of the VEGF pathways.
We initially had this very simplistic idea that there was one VEGF ligand that bound to the receptor, and the ligand was made by the tumor cells, it bound to the receptor on the endothelial cells, and that made the endothelial cells grow, and you just sort of grew a new blood vessel by extending links on a chain. There are actually several different VEGF molecules. They're now up to A, B, C, D, and E. And each of those have different isoforms. They're produced in different parts of the body and have slightly different functions. There are at least three different VEGF receptors and two co-receptors. So it's a very redundant, very complicated system. That doesn't mean that we can't inhibit it, but it means we might have to inhibit it with more than one agent or in more than one place.
Can you talk about sort of what the normal function of these systems are?
I think we're still actually learning about the normal functions, and we partly learn about the normal functions by seeing what happens when you inhibit the pathway. So it was clear very early on that one of the things VEGF did was maintain sort of vascular integrity and vascular tone. So if you infuse extra VEGF into an animal or a person, they tend to have a decrease in their blood pressure. They get a lot of peripheral edema and leakage of fluid from their small vessels. And if you inhibit VEGF, you see exactly the opposite. Their vessels tend to be less leaky. And at least some of those patients will develop hypertension. Now, VEGF also plays a role in wound healing and sort of physiologic angiogenesis in response to surgery or major injury or fracture. And it may also have an effect in the immune system because VEGF also is important or has a role in inhibiting some of the antigen-presenting dendritic cells. So excess VEGF may also function as a sort of physiologic immune suppressant.
So let's move from that to VEGF as it relates to cancer. What do we know?
Well, we know that it's also a lot more complicated. So one of the things that's been identified in the last couple of years is that VEGF receptors are on some cancer cells and may have a role in an autocrine or paracrine way of stimulating or maintaining growth of the cancer cells themselves and not just the vasculature. VEGF can also be produced or released from some of the tumor stroma cells. So it's not just made by the tumor cells themselves.
Now, the fact that VEGF receptors have been seen in tumor cells, how long have we known that?
It's probably been at least 3 years. It was initially studied or identified in some leukemias and lymphomas, and most of the earlier work was in the hematologic malignancies and was sort of thought that this wouldn't apply to solid tumors. It's now been very well documented in breast cancer that at least some breast cancers have VEGF receptors. They're sometimes expressed on the surface, sometimes only expressed internally in the cell, but could still function as sort of an internal autocrine loop. What is less clear is how critical is their function on those cells. We know that they're there, but to what extent they're really functional or they contribute to the biology of that cancer cell is not yet as clear.
Can you talk a little bit about what bevacizumab does?
So bevacizumab binds to the VEGF-A, which is one of the VEGF ligands. VEGF-A has at least four different isoforms, and bevacizumab binds to all four of those isoforms. So it certainly would not completely inhibit VEGF signaling because it wouldn't inhibit other VEGF forms that might be there. It doesn't inhibit the other ligands that bind to the VEGF receptors. But VEGF-A seems to be one of the predominant forms that is produced by many solid tumors. So it was a logical target to develop that antibody.
Do we know more specifically what happens in terms of the effect of VEGF in breast cancer?
I think we know some things. If you inhibit VEGF in breast cancer, it certainly does decrease the ability of those tumors to develop new blood vessels. It's probably even more important for maintenance of those newly formed vessels. So one of the things that VEGF does is provide critical survival signals. And that may actually be its more important role, because there are a lot of things that the tumor can produce to stimulate growth of blood vessels. But once you've established this very new blood vessel, you also have to keep it from just degrading. And VEGF is one of the things that is produced and continues to be produced once the vessel has been formed to provide those survival signals. And that may account for some of our early findings in those first clinical trials, where we expected to see the leading edges of tumors start to be pruned back or not grow. And what we saw actually was clearing in the center of a tumor while the leading edges continued to progress in some cases.
Before we get more into some of the clinical research, I'm curious about some of the translational studies that have been done. A couple that I found interesting are Sandy Swain's study in inflammatory breast cancer and actually Chris Willett's study in rectal cancer. Can you talk about those two and maybe other studies like that that I might not be aware of?
Well, one of the functions of VEGF, at least in some animal model systems, is by decreasing the vascular permeability and pruning the most non-functional of those vessels. It may actually improve transiently the perfusion of those tumors by decreasing the interstitial tumor pressure. Now, that's been very well documented by Rakesh Jain and his group in some of the animal systems. It's been much more difficult to document in human tumors because you need to be able to get a probe into the tumor to measure the interstitial pressure. Chris Willett did a very small study in patients with rectal cancer who were getting bevacizumab as an initial single dose alone and then in combination with radiation therapy. Now, there actually is a potential complicating factor that I don't think they controlled for in their study. So what they did is do a colonoscopy and measure with a direct probe inserted in the tumor from the luminal side the interstitial pressure before treatment and then after their first bevacizumab dose. But if you think about it, that probe measuring the interstitial pressure measures not just the interstitial pressure of the tumor, it also measures the intraluminal pressure in the colon. And to do the colonoscopy, you have to inflate the colon with gas. And they didn't actually measure the intraluminal pressure, and they didn't control for whether the colon was inflated to the same pressure or the same amount in those sequential colonoscopies. Not doing colonoscopies myself, it seems unlikely that you would have exactly the same pressure in the lumen. So without controlling for that, I think it's hard to interpret their data. Now, that data did show a decrease in interstitial pressure after bevacizumab, but it was a very small study. It was only 5 or 6 patients that they've reported on. So without controlling for the intraluminal pressure, it's a bit difficult to be positive that that data is correct. There is a separate study that was just recently reported in breast cancer that also measured interstitial pressure in patients with locally advanced primary breast cancers receiving neoadjuvant chemotherapy. And they looked at patients who were receiving either paclitaxel, which has been well studied and we know has some separate anti-angiogenic, anti-endothelial effects, or patients receiving doxorubicin, where that has really been very difficult to show. And their results were fascinating and are not complicated by this intraluminal pressure issue. They saw a significant decrease in the interstitial pressure in the patients receiving paclitaxel, but essentially no difference in the interstitial pressure in the patients receiving doxorubicin, even though the clinical responses with those two therapies were essentially identical.
And that was combined with bevacizumab?
No, that was with the chemotherapy alone.
Oh, just from chemotherapy?
Yeah, it was a fascinating, fairly small study in the neighborhood of 40 patients, but it was a fascinating investigation into the biology, because even though the response rates were the same, the mechanism by which you achieved those responses might be quite different.
What do you think was going on?
I suspect that you saw a combination of both direct tumor effects and anti-angiogenic effects with the paclitaxel, and you only saw the direct cytotoxic effects with doxorubicin. And that would potentially account for why you saw a decrease in interstitial pressure with one drug but not with the other.
From my primitive non-laboratory science mind, when I hear about decreased interstitial pressure and increasing perfusion of chemotherapy into cells. That's about as much as I've been able to figure out about Chris Willett's study. It seems like that was a little counterintuitive in terms of what, quote, anti-angiogenesis was supposed to be doing.
It initially is, but if you delve a little bit deeper into the vasculature of a tumor, it starts to make sense. The vasculature of a tumor is an incredibly disordered, largely non-functional structure. It has lots of leaky vessels, it has lots of blind loops and things that don't connect, it has lots of areas where there is minimal or very sluggish flow with little microthrombi that tend to come and go. So there are a lot more vessels in a tumor than in normal tissue, but many of those vessels are not very functional. And those vessels that are not very functional tend to be the ones that don't have a lot of pericyte coverage. And the pericytes also provide critical survival signals. And without the pericytes, they are much more sensitive to inhibiting VEGF. So if you inhibit VEGF, one of the first things that happens is you prune those most sensitive, least functional components of the tumor vasculature. And that could lead to an increase in perfusion, at least transiently. Now, that's been well documented in animal studies, much more difficult to document in patients. And what is still not clear is to what extent, if any, that actually accounts for the clinical responses that we see. Because it may absolutely be true, but be completely unimportant for what these drugs actually accomplish for us in the clinic.
I'm hoping, like probably a lot of oncologists listening to this right now, that the more I hear this, the more eventually it's going to make sense to me. But how about Sandy Swain's study in inflammatory breast cancer? Can you talk about that?
Well, Sandy Swain's study used some different technology and was in patients with locally advanced or inflammatory breast cancer. They were treated with a single dose of bevacizumab and then had docetaxel and doxorubicin added to the bevacizumab for the rest of their neoadjuvant therapy. They did a whole host of correlative studies, including biopsies to try and look at some genomic array studies. They didn't directly measure the tumor interstitial pressure, but they did use the dynamic contrast MRI to try and measure the perfusion as well as the permeability of those vessels after an initial dose of bevacizumab and then after a couple of doses of the combined therapy. They also obviously measured the clinical response and they collected blood and serum samples for a bunch of other circulating correlative studies. I think what was perhaps most interesting and not surprising to me is that they saw improvements in the appearance of some of those patients with inflammatory breast cancer even after their first dose of bevacizumab before they'd even gotten chemotherapy. And if you think about the intense vasculature and the leakiness of those structures with all of the skin edema and inflammatory breast cancer, it's hopefully not surprising that you would expect to see improvement just with an anti-angiogenic agent, at least in the short term.
And actually, Sandy just says that the patients actually felt the breast being not as warm.
Yes, which is exactly what you would expect if you have pruned some of those vessels, decreased the overall vascular structure, decreased leaking of intravascular fluid into the tumor interstitium. You would expect the breast to be less warm. You'd expect it to feel less heavy and less engorged to those patients. And you might see an increase in perfusion if you actually measure that by the dynamic contrast MRI in the short term.
You talked about paclitaxel and its presumed antiagenic effect. What other chemotherapeutic agents or schedules, particularly the metronomic approach, have that kind of mechanism?
This has been documented for docetaxel as well, so it seems to be a taxane class phenomenon, not something necessarily specific to one or the other taxanes.
Now paclitaxel also?
It's been documented with both paclitaxel and docetaxel.
But not NAB.
I don't know that they've actually looked with the NAB paclitaxel.
Interesting.
In fact, I'm positive they haven't looked at this point.
And how much is it schedule dependent with taxanes?
The schedule with the taxanes has not been investigated as much. In the laboratory, you can see a separate effect on the endothelial cells at much lower doses of the taxanes and at doses that don't have any direct cytotoxic effect. What's not clear without studying it carefully is whether you actually lose that effect if you use higher doses in a more intermittent schedule. And that's definitely what you see with some of the other cytotoxics. So with cyclophosphamide or with phenobarbital, using them at lower doses that really don't have a direct cytotoxic effect, have much less toxicity, don't cause myelosuppression, don't increase circulating endothelial cells or circulating bone marrow progenitors, you see a significant effect on the endothelium and a direct anti-angiogenic effect. If you increase the dose, you get a direct cytotoxic effect, but you lose the anti-angiogenic effect.
Interesting. What about other chemotherapeutic agents and schedules?
Those have been the ones that have been the most heavily studied. It becomes a very confusing literature that we tried to review a few years ago. And if you look, you can find reports of virtually every chemotherapeutic agent that has been said to be anti-angiogenic by someone somewhere on the basis of some assay. The difficulty is actually looking at the doses, and they often did not separate the doses that you needed to see the supposed anti-angiogenic or anti-endothelial effect from the doses that you needed to have a direct cytotoxic effect on tumor cells. And many of those reports didn't see that effect until they were at doses that were near the MTD in animals and clearly had a direct cytotoxic effect. So I don't think this is something that will be true for every cytotoxic agent.
So when you're trying to investigate whether an agent is, quote, anti-angiogenic, what do you look at?
We actually put together several criteria that we thought if you're going to say this drug has an anti-angiogenic activity, we think this is what you should mean. And that included it should have a separate effect on either endothelial proliferation or endothelial function that was at doses different and typically much lower than would be required for direct cytotoxicity. So if you throw enough of the drug on cells and they all die, that doesn't tell you that it has a separate effect on the endothelial cell. So we're really talking about a differential sensitivity to endothelial cell proliferation or function.
So that's my dose of laboratory science for this interview. And just, like I say, I'm hoping that repetitively it's sort of going to sink in. Someday I'll understand.
It makes this much more interesting.
Oh, yeah. It's great stuff. Okay, let's get back.
And it does start to explain some of the observations we had in the clinic that otherwise made no sense.
Like what?
Well, in the first bevacizumab phase 2 trial, there were several patients who had fairly extensive cutaneous involvement of their tumor, these sort of plaque-like lesions that all clinicians have seen and come to fear. And what we expected was that these lesions would stop growing. They'd perhaps regress from the leading edges, but we didn't expect to see much else than that. What we actually saw was the center of these lesions started clearing. They would go from being a very bright red erythematous color to this more brownish kind of old blood, almost tanning appearance. They would sometimes become very hyperkeratotic in the middle, and then the scab would fall off with normal appearing skin underneath in sort of dead center of these established lesions, while the edges continued to progress and would eventually go through the same transition. And that would perfectly match multiple proangiogenic factors being produced at the leading edge of a lesion, with most of those then not being produced long-term, but VEGF being produced long-term as a survival factor. So that inhibiting VEGF removes those critical survival functions and those established but not normal vessels regress in the middle of the lesion. But since so many other factors are produced at the edge of the tumor, the lesions continue to grow.
Okay, you're pulling me in there a little bit. What about the hypertension?
Hypertension would certainly be expected from knowing that infusing VEGF causes hypotension. What is not clear and what we haven't figured out yet is why everybody doesn't get hypertension. Because all dogs get hypotension if you infuse VEGF, so why don't all people get hypertension by blocking VEGF? And we have actually hoped that someone interested in hypertension might pick up on this lead because it could potentially teach us something about risk factors for essential hypertension or therapies for hypertension in some patients.
What about bowel perforation and GI cancers?
That actually, I think, is fairly simple in that many, though not all of those patients either had involvement of the bowel wall with their tumor or had had a recent surgery and anastomosis, and their perforations were almost always in one of those two areas.
I actually heard differently from the GI people that a lot of them weren't in those areas.
There were some that were not, but a lot of them were in those areas. And this is a problem that has really only been seen in patients with GI tumors and in patients with ovarian cancer, which frequently involves a lot of the same surfaces. This is not something that's been seen in the lung cancer trials or the breast cancer trials. So I think this is not necessarily teaching us something about biology and physiology. It's purely an anatomic issue. Very similar to you saw significant pulmonary hemorrhage in patients with large central lung lesions, but not in breast cancer patients with small peripheral lung lesions.
I was going to ask you about the pulmonary lesions. So are you saying that both of these things are related to tumor response?
In many cases, they were. In many cases, the lung hemorrhage were in patients that were responding. You had this large lesion that suddenly became cavitary. And it's not hard to imagine if you have a large lesion wrapped around a big vessel and it suddenly becomes cavitary, this big vessel is now pumping into a hole, and that's a problem. We actually saw lung lesions cavitate in the phase 2 trial in patients with breast cancer. But these were, you know, 2-centimeter peripheral lung lesions. If they had any hemorrhage into those lesions, it would have been from small capillaries and it would have never been clinically apparent. So I don't think it was something unique about squamous cell cancer biology. I suspect it's much more a function of anatomy and what's in the region that would be at risk if you suddenly eliminate a bunch of the smaller blood vessels in the structure.
Yeah, that's kind of what I'm hearing the lung people talking about. What about the migraines?
Migraines, I suspect, are also related to changes in vascular tone. They were clearly dose-related, though they were not related necessarily to hypertension, but we suspect that they were related to changes in vascular tone. But that also has not been very well studied.
Speaking of dose, can you comment on the different doses that have been used in the different tumors and what all that means?
I think it means that we did some not very smart things in doing the earlier studies because that's how we got into this difference in dose. So breast cancer did not have any randomized dose-finding studies. We did a sequential cohort study, initially planned to look at 2 different dose levels, 3 milligrams per kilogram every 2 weeks or 10 milligrams per kilogram every 2 weeks. The 3 milligram dose was chosen because that was the dose from the phase 1 study that eliminated circulating VEGF from all of the patients. The 10 milligram dose was one of the highest doses that had been studied in the phase 1. And though you eliminated circulating VEGF at lower dose levels, we wondered if perhaps in the tumor microenvironment where VEGF is produced, you might need a higher concentration or a higher dose to get the same effect. In that study, we thought there was greater activity at the 10 milligram dose than the 3 milligram dose. So the study was amended to look at an even higher dose, the 20 milligram per kilogram every 2 weeks. And we didn't really see any increase in activity at 20, but saw the migraines and the dose-limiting toxicity of the drug that to that point had not been identified. The lung and colon trials and programs proceeded a little bit differently in that they did each a randomized phase 2 study looking at either 5 milligrams per kilogram every 2 weeks or 10 per kilogram every 2 weeks. I think the lung trial was actually every 3 weeks, but those equivalent doses, either 5 milligrams per kilogram per week or 2.5 milligrams per kilogram per week. And in the lung cancer trial, the higher dose appeared superior, and in the colon cancer trial, the lower dose appeared superior. So they used those doses going forward. I think if anything, it teaches us to be cautious with randomized phase 2 studies because they're small and they're not designed to have a direct comparison. So those results could just as easily have been spurious than teaching us anything true about doses. Now, that said, I don't know that the dose we picked for the breast cancer trials is the right dose because it came from a fairly small sequential phase 2 study. So there are plans to do a randomized phase 3 study looking at 2 different dose levels of bevacizumab in breast cancer that will be starting very soon if it's not started already.
Again, before we get into the clinical data of bevacizumab and breast cancer, can you comment on some of the various TKIs that are out there, including Sutent that you recently reported on?
There are lots of different ways that you could inhibit VEGF, and one way that has gotten a lot of attention is to develop a small molecule tyrosine kinase inhibitor. And that has some potential advantages because you could perhaps develop a TKI that would inhibit all three of the VEGF receptors or perhaps other of the receptors that are important in angiogenesis. And that might be very important for getting greater efficacy because this is such a redundant system. Now, that entails the risk of greater toxicity because you're inhibiting signaling through more receptors as well. There are several of those that are in active clinical development. Not all of them have been studied at this point in breast cancer. The one that has probably been studied the most in breast cancer is known as SU11248 and is now known as Sutent. It inhibits all three of the VEGF receptors. It also inhibits the platelet-derived growth factors alpha and beta, which is particularly important for the pericyte coverage and survival of those blood vessels. It also inhibits c-KIT, including wild-type c-KIT, FLT3, and the c-RET receptor, though we expect those others to be perhaps less important for most breast cancer patients. We did a phase 2 monotherapy trial of this agent in patients with very heavily pretreated breast cancer. The protocol required that they have therapy with an anthracycline and a taxane, and they had to be resistant to one of those agents, defined as either progression while on or within 12 months of last receiving one of those drugs. And they were allowed to have had up to 2 non-anthracycline, non-taxane-containing regimens for metastatic disease. So the oncologists in the community immediately recognized that that means you have a lot of wiggle room and the amount of therapy you can give these patients, and they're still eligible for the trial. The trial enrolled 64 patients and had a response rate of 11% with an additional 3 patients who were stable for more than 6 months. And while that sounds like a fairly modest response rate, that's actually not bad at all in such a heavily pretreated patient population. So this drug is actively moving forward in several other trials in breast cancer.
To me, you show me a case where you had a clear-cut, absolute objective response, and one of them would be good enough to get me interested. Any patients in the trial that you could talk about in terms of maybe interesting responses?
Well, there's one actually that has some perhaps instructions in biology as well that I took care of. This was a patient who had the triple negative ERPR and HER2 negative phenotype, who actually had presented with metastatic disease, though that was not recognized prospectively. She had had a couple of lung nodules that were sort of called indeterminate, though 2 of them were above 1 centimeter and were probably stretching that definition a bit. She got initially treated with an anthracycline regimen and then a taxane regimen with her primary breast intact and had progression of those lung nodules after both of those therapies.
What happened in the breast?
Decreased with the first one and then grew with the second one, and I forget which order.
And she was clearly progressing in the lung?
She had clearly progressed in the lung, and it was at that point that they biopsied one of the lung lesions and proved that it was metastatic disease and then referred her to me. She had also been treated with Xeloda, and it had stable disease for a very brief period of time before she enrolled in the trial, and had a partial response in both her lung lesions and the breast lesions while she was on the study, and was on the trial for about 7 or 8 months until her disease progressed.
How big was the breast lesion and how did it decrease?
Her breast lesion was more difficult to measure because it had very indistinct borders. Her largest lung lesion was about 3 centimeters when she started and decreased to just over 1 centimeter. One of her other lung lesions became cavitary and then resolved until the time of her progression. But what was interesting was that of the 7 patients who had an objective response to this agent as monotherapy, 3 of them had the triple negative phenotype. And that's the only subgroup of breast cancer patients that have c-KIT expression at any frequency that might be clinically useful. So perhaps that might explain why they seemed to be more likely to respond. Now, realize this is a small phase 2 study. It's an interesting hypothesis, and it's actually one that we're following up on in an ongoing trial that just started.
To what extent has imatinib been looked at in breast cancer?
Not much. A couple of small combination studies, not much as a single agent. With the difference being that in the triple negatives that express c-KIT, it's almost always wild-type c-KIT, and imatinib does not inhibit the wild-type c-KIT, but the SU11248 inhibits wild-type c-KIT as well.
What are some of the other TK inhibitors that have been tested in clinical settings, not just in breast cancer, but in other settings?
There are several others. Many of your listeners will be familiar with the Novartis compound PTK787, studied most heavily in colon cancer. We're doing a small study with that compound in combination with trastuzumab for patients with HER2-positive breast cancer that has just gotten started, so we don't have results thus far.
Now, when you described the mechanism of action of Sutent, it sounded a lot like the way PTK-ZK has been described.
Yes, they have very similar, though not completely overlapping, spectrum of the TKs that they inhibit. And there are actually several other drugs with other companies that have similar but not completely identical spectrums. One of them was the SU11248. The other one is the Bayer compound, now known as sorafenib. That has not been studied well in breast cancer at this point.
Again, in terms of mechanism of action, to what extent is that similar to Sutent?
Very similar spectrum, though the potencies and sort of the order of potencies of the tyrosine kinases that they inhibit are slightly different.
What about the side effects and toxicity profile of Sutent and the other TK inhibitors?
Very different than with bevacizumab as monotherapy. Bevacizumab as monotherapy causes essentially no myelosuppression, and there is myelosuppression with many of these TKIs, we assume because of their inhibition of wild-type c-KIT and inhibition of FLT3. They also do cause hypertension, which we've seen with almost every compound that has inhibited VEGF signaling in some way. And they've had some other toxicities that we're still trying to understand. So they've had some hand-foot syndrome that has seemed very similar to classical cytotoxic hand-foot syndrome, though often not nearly as severe. And they have had an unusual mouth pain syndrome that is very different than sort of typical cytotoxic mucositis. There's usually nothing to see. The oral mucosa looks perfectly normally, but patients will describe it as if their mouth is on fire or they've sipped something hot and their tongue is sensitive to changes in temperature or acidic foods for several days afterwards. For some patients, that was a minor annoyance. For some, it really became very limiting in what they could comfortably eat. We saw very minor versions of that in patients in the bevacizumab trial, but it's been much more pronounced in the trials with the tyrosine kinase inhibitors.
Okay, let's move on to the practical issues. And can you talk about the clinical trials that have been done with bevacizumab and breast cancer?
The first one was the monotherapy trial that looked at 75 patients sequentially enrolled in three different dose cohorts. Overall, it was an objective response rate of about 9% and about 17% of patients who were responding or stable at 5 months, which is a little bit unconventional time point, but that was one of the time points that the protocol required that you evaluate their disease. So we know that that's a solid endpoint. And four of those 75 patients were treated for at least a year without progression. That led to a randomized trial in patients with refractory disease looking at either capecitabine alone or capecitabine with bevacizumab. That trial required patients to have had previous therapy with an anthracycline and a taxane, and they actually could have had up to two previous chemotherapies for metastatic disease, so they were a pretty advanced group. That trial enrolled 462 patients and found essentially a doubling of response rates by adding bevacizumab. But that doubling went from 9% to 19% in the eyes of the independent review facility. It went from about 19% to 30% in the eyes of the investigators. But those low response rates really did not budge the median progression-free survivals, which was the primary endpoint of that trial, and did not alter the overall survival.
While you're mentioning that, Lee Ellis makes the point that a number of trials in different tumors have shown increased response rates. Why do you think you see an increased response rate with this agent based on the mechanism of action?
I think there are a couple of potential reasons. One is if the increase in perfusion in the short term actually does result in greater delivery of the chemotherapy, that's one potential explanation. Though that wouldn't explain the few patients that we saw who had objective responses to monotherapy with an anti-angiogenic agent. We know that some solid tumors do express the VEGF receptors on the cancer cells, so if those are providing growth or survival signals, then blocking that might be important. There is actually some laboratory evidence for that, that if you increase VEGF in the culture media, cells tend to become more resistant to chemotherapy. And if you block VEGF, you can restore the sensitivity. So that may be part of the reason as well. And we've sort of come to think of VEGF as one of the mechanisms of chemotherapy resistance. So if you eliminate that, you give patients the same opportunity to respond. And it may also be truly through the anti-angiogenic effect that you're killing the same number of cells with the chemotherapy, but preventing some of the cells that are resistant to the chemotherapy from growing as rapidly because they can't get the same blood supply. And in some patients, that difference between growth fractions and death fractions could result in a partial response that you wouldn't see otherwise.
Before we go on to the other studies, given its pretty favorable side effects profile, do you think that there's a role for monotherapy in the clinical setting?
I think it's difficult to propose monotherapy. I mean, we certainly saw some activity in those heavily pretreated patients, but it was very modest and a very few number of patients. If you have somebody who is heavily pretreated and still in good shape and able to get the drug, I don't have any major objections. But I don't think that's using the drug in the way that would be most beneficial for patients. And our clinical trial data certainly shows that the earlier you use this drug in the natural history of the disease, the more likely patients are to benefit and the more prolonged that benefit will be.
Okay, so we had the capecitabine study that some people found encouraging and others found disappointing, and then we moved on.
Yes, well, I actually reported it as a negative trial, though I was more encouraged than discouraged by the results.
I remember we talked right at San Antonio when you presented it, and I thought it was pretty cool too. But overall, I would say that people have been not too encouraged by it.
I think it was a difficult trial to report because the primary endpoint was progression-free survival. So it had to be reported as a negative trial because it didn't meet that endpoint. But I think we actually learned a lot from that trial, and there was more good news in the results than there was bad news. If you look at the results of those trials and the pathology correlative studies that pretty clearly show that as breast cancers progress, the number of pro-angiogenic factors that they express increases. It's hard to think how inhibiting one very late in the game would give you a demonstrable clinical effect or an effect that would last very long. But inhibiting that same one much earlier, when there's less redundancy in the system, might give you a much greater effect. And that really was the idea behind the E2100 trial, which had a very similar design, but used paclitaxel instead of capecitabine, primarily because we were looking in earlier stage patients, most of whom had not had a taxane as part of their adjuvant therapy, that about 18% of them actually had. And they had not had previous chemotherapy for their recurrent disease. So they were all randomized to either paclitaxel or paclitaxel with bevacizumab. That trial enrolled 680 eligible patients. And in some ways, the results sort of mirrored the earlier trial. It was essentially a doubling of response rates, though the baseline response rates were a bit higher than in the more refractory population. And in this setting, that translated into a very striking improvement in progression-free survival of over 5 months, from 6.1 months in the patients randomized to the paclitaxel alone to 11.4 months in patients randomized to the combination. I didn't expect the results to be at ASCO because the data monitoring committee wasn't meeting until early April. So we had long since missed the abstract deadline and a late-breaking deadline, and actually had not submitted a late-breaking abstract because we didn't expect that we would have the results in time for the deadlines. So it was actually included as a separate educational program, largely because the leadership of the ASCO Breast Committee thought that the results were important enough, along with the adjuvant trastuzumab results, that we needed to get them out to the public as quickly as possible.
Yeah, that was encouraging that they could react so quickly. And that May 16th session was very historic. And seeing you up there on the podium with Eric Weiner talking about that and then all the trastuzumab stuff, that was probably one of the best days in oncology of all time.
It was incredibly fun to be a part of that day. There was just such phenomenal energy in the room. And I think the energy was because you could see the fruits of understanding biology. And then if you really understand the biology and you design therapies to interact with that biology and you test them in the right way, in a way that respects what we think we know about the biology, you can get truly amazing results rather than the small incremental improvements that we're so used to seeing.
Well, I mean, that was the theory, but we'd been getting beat up for a long time because nothing was really happening that was helping many patients. And seeing those trastuzumab curves and seeing your stuff was mighty encouraging.
I think we learned a lot from those negative studies along the way. And sometimes we learned that we didn't understand the biology as well as we thought we did. And those clinical observations then led to additional laboratory studies that improved our understanding. Sometimes we learned that we understood the biology just fine, but we designed a trial that didn't respect that biology at all. So we shouldn't have been surprised by those negative results.
Can you kind of put into clinical or human context what the benefit meant, and from your point of view, extending progression-free survival? You're still talking about, you know, 5 or 6 months as opposed to a couple years. At this point, I guess it's a little too early to even be looking at survival. But how does that compare to other trials or other strategies, adding a second chemotherapeutic agent to a first one? What do you think it means clinically?
It's been interesting to me to hear people respond to those results, because I think there truly is very little comparison. In fact, there is only one trial that has found a 5 month or more improvement in progression-free survival. And that was the first randomized trial that added trastuzumab to chemotherapy in patients with HER2-positive disease. And I don't remember anybody, when those results were first reported, saying, well, it's only 5 months, so what did you really gain? Ours is actually a slightly greater improvement, but they're the only ones that have come close to that 5 month mark. And it's been interesting to me the difference in reaction, because I don't remember people having that reaction with the trastuzumab trials.
Well, I think also one of the things I heard a lot after ASCO was, quote, we already have so many effective agents in breast cancer, you know, ho-hum, whereas maybe in 1998 or when the trastuzumab was out, we didn't have quite as much, although I'm not sure I bought into the concept that things were so great.
And I can't think of other dramatically active agents that we got between 1998 and 2005. So we certainly do have more active agents than many of the other solid tumors that patients and their physicians are faced with. But there's still a much bigger difference in the benefits that we get with bevacizumab, and I'm particularly struck by the difference in toxicity. So in all of the trials that have looked at adding another chemotherapy drug, they've typically found 2, 2.5, maybe 3 months improvement in progression-free survival, but frequently at the cost of substantial increases in toxicity, whereas we had really very minimal differences in toxicity. I think you also have to keep in mind that that 5 months is an improvement in the median. So there are some patients who got no benefit from any of the therapies, but those are counterbalanced by patients who got a lot more than a 5 month improvement with therapy that had minimal toxicity and was not nearly as disruptive to continuing a very active, otherwise healthy life as if they had continued on chemotherapy.
What about the issue of crossover? We've kind of been sensitized to that issue because of the combination chemotherapy studies. I know in the San Antonio meeting, Martine Picard stood up and questioned you about that. Can you kind of review how was the trial structured in terms of crossover?
E2100 did not include a crossover. So we had no provisions for patients who were randomized to paclitaxel to have bevacizumab at the time of progression. For at least part of the life of the trial, bevacizumab was approved and commercially available for colon cancer. So it's possible that a few of our patients might have been able to get access to the drug for crossover at that point, though since it was only approved for colon cancer and the costs are prohibitive for most patients, I think the likelihood of that really contaminating our study with a lot of crossover is really minimal. We talked a lot about whether we should have a crossover in 2100, and we decided not to for a couple of pragmatic reasons. One is that it would have made the trial a lot more complicated and a lot more expensive to do, and our primary endpoint was progression-free survival. So having a crossover would not have contributed to our primary endpoint at all. At the time E2100 was designed, we didn't have the results of the capecitabine trial, but we got those results within the first year of E2100 being open for accrual. And those patients who've now progressed on their first chemotherapy are the largest group of patients who enrolled in the capecitabine trial. which found improvements in response rate, but no improvements in progression-free survival. So it was hard at that point to justify going back and amending 2100 to provide a crossover based on results of a negative trial in that patient population. But the people who point to this as a criticism of the design and who wonder when we actually have survival data that will be meaningful, if those survival data would be different if we had allowed or provided for a crossover, have a very legitimate criticism. I think the data in more advanced people would suggest that that's not likely to influence our results. But without a trial that includes a crossover, I certainly don't have data that will prove that.
I guess also, too, I mean, a lot of people kind of look at this as really just a signal that has biologic implications and hopefully implications for the adjuvant setting. Hopefully it's going to have improvement in quality of life and metastatic disease, but I don't think that's sort of the final endpoint that we're looking for.
No, we think the results will be even greater in the adjuvant setting because, you know, first chemotherapy for metastatic disease is actually fairly late in the natural history of breast cancer if you start from the time the malignancy first develops. Even though our patients hadn't had chemotherapy for metastatic disease, 2/3 of them had had chemotherapy. 18% had had an anthracycline and a taxane. So these were not chemotherapy naive patients. They actually were much more advanced than the first line metastatic patients enrolled in trials a decade ago. We expect much greater activity in the adjuvant setting, and there's some recent laboratory data that really supports that in the adjuvant setting, we're likely to see much greater activity.
Laboratory data, huh? Okay, tell me about the laboratory data.
You can cut this out, but need to see this. It's fascinating.
Okay, tell me about it.
So what they found was that at sites of future metastasis, the first cell type that populates a site of metastasis is not the cancer cell, but are bone marrow-derived circulating endothelial cells, and those are VEGF-driven.
What are they doing there?
They essentially are sent out as emissaries under circulating control of the cancer cells and sort of to prepare the microenvironment for cancer cells to populate. And in animal studies, you can find these islands of bone marrow-derived VEGF receptor 1 positive circulating progenitors that land at sites of future metastasis several days before tumor cells arrive. And if you do the study in transgenic mice that don't have the VEGF receptor 1, or you block the VEGF receptor 1, you dramatically decrease the population of these bone marrow-derived progenitors, and you dramatically decrease metastasis. It's absolutely fascinating.
Wow, that's interesting.
It would give further support that this might have even greater activity in an adjuvant setting.
You mentioned the prior adjuvant taxanes, and that was something new that you presented in San Antonio, which was very interesting. Can you talk about that?
Well, we had allowed in the design of V2100 for patients who had received a taxane-containing adjuvant regimen to enroll as long as their disease-free interval was at least 12 months. And we did that for pragmatic reasons, that the taxanes were being used more frequently in the adjuvant setting, and we thought it would be reasonable to consider retreating those patients if their disease-free interval was not particularly short or was at least a year. About 18% of our patients actually had had a taxane-containing regimen. Their hazard ratio was 0.38, was actually the best hazard ratio of all of the clinically based subsets that we evaluated. So for those patients, that translated into an improvement, not from 6 to 11 months, but from 4 to just over 12 months in their median progression-free survival.
What about the issue of predictors of response or the lack of and where that's going to head?
I think at this point it's really lack of predictors of response, which is one of our great frustrations. We have looked at a bunch of clinically based subsets in our E2100 data, including disease-free interval, previous therapy, steroid receptor status, sites of disease, and really could not identify a subset that didn't seem to benefit from adding bevacizumab.
What about the VEGF receptors on the cells? Has that been looked at?
That has not been looked at, though we have a lot of other plans for the E2100 correlative studies. We have archived primary tumor blocks from over 500 of the patients who were enrolled on E2100. Those are going to be looked at for VEGF expression as an initial test. We're also going to be using those to look at VEGF polymorphisms. And there are at least 5 polymorphisms of VEGF-A that have been identified side, they all in some way decrease the potency of VEGF, either by decreasing its production or decreasing stability of the protein. They've been studied in other settings, and there's been suggestions that they decrease the risk of disease or decrease the aggressiveness of disease. But we have no idea if they influence the response to a VEGF inhibition or in that sort of therapy. There are 11 polymorphisms of the VEGF receptor 2, which is the one that we think is the most important. Those have been completely unstudied, but in some recent computer modeling that my colleague Brian Schneider did, one of those polymorphisms alters the ATP binding domain of the kinase, and you would expect to have a significant impact on function. So we are also going to be looking at polymorphisms in the VEGF receptor 2 to see if those host factors, those are genetic characteristics of the host, not something specific to the tumor, might influence response. We are hoping to get support and approval to use those same samples to do some genomic array studies to look at whether different mutations or combinations of gene expression within the tumor will affect response. And we've also collected in a serial fashion serum and urine for a variety of circulating markers, none of which to date have really panned out in predicting response, so we still have those samples stored. So if other possibilities come up, we'll be able to go back and interrogate those samples some more.
Well, we're still moving towards what all this means clinically today, but first, let's talk a little bit about some of the trials that are going on right now, clinical trials that may affect clinical decision-making over the next couple of years.
One of the trials that we activated shortly after we had the results of the E2100 trial was a phase 2 trial known as Excalibur, which is probably my favorite trial name of all the trials I've been involved with.
My favorite was always MOP, but okay, continue.
Not sure I would want to get MOP if I was a patient. So the Excalibur trial uses the capecitabine bevacizumab combination from the earlier phase 3 trial, but in first-line metastatic patients. So it's essentially the E2100 patient population using the capecitabine bevacizumab trial, and we thought that was a very reasonable trial to do because we had ample safety data from the combination. We knew that adding bevacizumab improved the response rates to capecitabine, and it would potentially give patients in that first chemotherapy metastatic setting another option of chemotherapy and an option that would be oral that wouldn't cause alopecia that for some patients might have a lot of advantages if we saw similar response rates and similar progression-free survival in a decent-sized phase 2 study. So that trial should be finishing enrollment sometime in the next 4 to 6 weeks, I would estimate.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, when you think about in colon cancer, clearly bevacizumab adds to 5-FU. So I guess you would expect it ought to work.
Well, you certainly would expect so, and our trial in refractory patients found a doubling of response rates. So we have data that would strongly suggest this will be active. What we don't know is whether we'll get the same response and progression-free survival as with the paclitaxel-based regimen. And I think that would be an important piece of data to know clinically to allow people a little greater flexibility in their first chemotherapy with bevacizumab regimen.
Any other interesting trials in the metastatic setting before we talk about adjuvant?
There are a couple of trials that I think will be very important for us. Mark Pegram and his group at UCLA is doing a trial combining bevacizumab with trastuzumab in patients that are HER2 positive, because that's a group that we currently don't have much clinical data for. They were excluded from the E2100 trial and were required to have had previous trastuzumab, which then didn't continue in the capecitabine-based trial. But those are patients that have much higher VEGF levels or are more likely to have increased VEGF expression. So that's certainly a population where, based on the biology of their tumors, you would want to block both of those two signaling pathways. That phase 2 trial will then be expanded, we hope, into a phase 3 trial that has been proposed within ECOG that's currently being reviewed by NCI that will look at a taxane trastuzumab regimen with or without bevacizumab in those first-line patients.
And I guess hopefully eventually that all is going to go into the adjuvant setting.
There are ongoing discussions, I know, within the BCIRG about moving that into the adjuvant setting in their next trial for the HER2-positive population. The other group that I would like more information about to know what to do with clinically are the patients with ER-positive disease who don't yet need chemotherapy. The patients in E2100 were getting their first chemotherapy for metastatic disease, but many of them had had metastatic disease for several years, treated sequentially with hormone agents before they got to E2100. And one of the things that estrogen does is increase VEGF expression. So there's some biologic rationale for combining bevacizumab with hormonal-based therapies as well.
Hold on, rewind. Estrogen increases VEGF expression?
Estrogen in ER-positive breast cancer cells increases VEGF production, yes.
Hmm.
And blocking estrogen gives you a consequent decrease.
So are there trials actually ongoing right now looking at that?
There are. There is essentially a safety trial that's being coordinated with Maura Dickler and her colleagues at Memorial Sloan Kettering with letrozole. It's a trial that I hope people will not look at in the wrong way and get disappointed. Because I've already heard some people say they weren't very impressed with the response rates in their early reports. This trial was designed purely to look at safety. So the first part of the trial allowed patients who had been on an aromatase inhibitor for any period of time for metastatic disease but were not actively progressing to enter this trial and have bevacizumab added. And most of the patients that have been reported so far had actually been on an AI for quite some time, some of them for a couple of years before the bevacizumab was added. So I wouldn't expect to see these patients with prolonged stable disease who didn't have easily measurable disease suddenly have an easily identified objective response just by adding bevacizumab. That's a group that is definitely going to take a much larger study with this added at the time of their initial hormonal therapy to really see the benefits. But this was a first step in looking at whether there were any unique safety issues of combining this with hormone therapy. And they certainly found no safety signals that would limit you from moving forward.
So it seems like it would take a huge study if you're going to demonstrate an increased progression-free survival in the first-line setting?
It would take a very large study because those are patients who are often on hormone therapy for a long period of time. To try to limit it to patients who have measurable disease is difficult because many of those patients have bone-only disease that is not measurable. I don't know if there is a phase 3 study in the works in that patient population, but it certainly would be something worth entertaining because I would expect you would see significant benefits.
What about looking at it in the neoadjuvant setting?
There are some studies looking at bevacizumab in the neoadjuvant setting. The one complicating factor is whether that will interfere with wound healing at the time of surgery. In Sandy Swain's very small experience, there were 7 patients who either had wound dehiscence or significant seromas that seemed out of proportion to what they had seen before, both in severity and chronicity of those problems. Now, this could just be purely bad luck. These were all folks with very locally advanced disease. It's a very select population that makes their way to the NCI Clinical Center. But 7 out of 21 patients is a significant fraction that at least raises this as a concern in the neoadjuvant setting. I don't think we know nearly enough to know that it's prohibitive. And there's certainly a lot that could be learned about biology in the neoadjuvant setting that we would like to take advantage of.
You would think so. I heard a rumor that the infamous NSABP B40 study that's been in development for like 20
forever
years
forever and ever and ever
is now the latest iteration now that supposedly they're talking about adding in bevacizumab. It sounded like it'd be pretty cool. I mean, the last time I heard about it was going to be AC docetaxel alone versus AC docetaxel plus gem versus AC docetaxel plus capecitabine. And now I've heard they want to throw in another factor, which is bevacizumab, which actually sounds like it'd be pretty cool.
It would be. It would be interesting to see how they're going to deal with the potential surgical complications. I would hope they would build in an early look at surgical toxicity, which would be somewhat difficult to do because the timing that some of Sandy's patients ran into trouble was not immediately postoperatively. It was sometimes 4 to 5 months postoperatively.
Now, what I've been hearing is 6 weeks between the last bevacizumab dose and surgery.
Well, 6 weeks is a nice round number, but I'm not sure it's based on any safety data. And we know that bevacizumab at those doses eliminates measurable circulating VEGF for much longer than a month. So I'm not sure that 6 weeks sounds good, and it sounds like it ought to be long enough, but I'm not sure that it really would be. But I don't think we have any data from any of our trials that would give us any sense of how long might be long enough and whether that time frame would be compatible with the neoadjuvant study.
I think that's what Lee Ellis and Axel Grothy proposed in a JCO editorial. Of course, that was colon, but it was still the issue, how long do you wait for surgery? What about bevacizumab adjuvant studies? Of course, that's where it's all getting really exciting. Where are we right now?
The adjuvant pilot trial is openly enrolling patients within ECOG, and just within the last 2 days has been activated within the NCCTG. That trial is one that I think is really critically important to us, because we would be looking at adding bevacizumab to an anthracycline-based treatment regimen. And there to date is roughly 100 patients total who have ever been treated with anthracyclines and bevacizumab combined. And all of those studies have raised some question of increased cardiac toxicity.
What's the exact regimen?
The chemotherapy regimen in the adjuvant pilot trial uses the dose-dense AC followed by paclitaxel, as was used in the CALGB9741 study. And that trial is up and running now. It's actually looking at two different cohorts. So the first cohort has bevacizumab added with the anthracycline at the very beginning and throughout the therapy. The second cohort holds off and adds the bevacizumab with the paclitaxel and is sort of our backup if we do see cardiac toxicity issues with the combined administration, so that we'll have safety data with both strategies.
So we're going to have bevacizumab and Neulasta, and I can hear the concerns about cost, but hopefully it'll work.
This is the adjuvant pilot trial, which is a total of 212 patients. The full adjuvant trial is going to use a slightly different chemotherapy backbone that won't require growth factors. Now, certainly adding bevacizumab is going to add markedly to the cost, but if we can get the same sort of results, that benefit may suddenly seem worth that cost.
So why are you using a different chemo backbone in the pilot than in the real?
I wrote them 2.5 years apart.
Interesting.
Using AC on an every 3-week basis, followed by weekly paclitaxel, will be the chemotherapy backbone in the full adjuvant trial. And that was based on a couple of biologic considerations and a couple of practical considerations. The biologic consideration is that I really wanted to use a weekly taxane regimen, because the biggest support for moving this into the adjuvant setting is the E2100 data, which used a weekly taxane schedule. I don't have direct data to say we wouldn't have gotten the same improvements within every 3-week or every 2-week taxane schedule. But the data we have is with weekly. So we would like to use that regimen as close as possible as we move into the adjuvant setting.
Yeah, we don't need to edit it out. I mean, it's just things are changing, and the way people view things are changing pretty fast.
The biggest part of the biologic rationale, a sort of secondary rationale, was looking at the subset analyses from the CALGB trial and the recently reported E1199 trial in the ER-negative patients, where most of the benefit seemed to be obtained. The hazard ratios for the dose-dense regimen and the hazard ratio for the weekly paclitaxel regimen were essentially identical. It was a hazard ratio of 1.3. Now, those were different trials, slightly different patient populations, done at slightly different times with different amounts of follow-up. So it is far from a perfect or statistically legitimate comparison, but it at least puts their efficacy in the same range that I hope will give people comfort with that choice. The practical issues had to do with the trial will include a placebo control for the group that is not getting bevacizumab. And we had entertained allowing physicians to choose whether they wanted to use a dose-dense schedule or an every 3-week schedule for the AC. And that made things a practical nightmare and just logistically impossible, because you would have different durations of chemotherapy, some patients getting their therapy on an every 2-week basis, some on an every 3-week basis. So you would need a different dose of bevacizumab for patients based on their chemotherapy schedule that would then switch as they progressed in their treatment and moved on to the weekly taxane. And to try and figure out how to logistically manage that and make sure people were getting the right drugs in the right doses just became impossible as we looked at having a placebo control.
Placebo control infusion?
Yes, for the first 6 months.
Wow.
So the full adjuvant trial actually has 3 arms. The simple way to look at it is everybody gets the same chemotherapy. Arm A gets no bevacizumab. Arm B gets 6 months of bevacizumab, essentially concurrently with their chemotherapy. And arm C gets 12 months of bevacizumab, 6 months with chemotherapy and then an additional 6 months of maintenance. So the first 6 months of therapy are blinded and placebo-controlled, and at the end of chemotherapy, patients and their physicians will be told to which arm they have been randomized and whether they're continuing for an additional 6 months.
What about the issue of the arterial events? What do we know about at this point, both in terms of sort of what the incidence is and pathophysiology?
What we know about the incidence is that adding bevacizumab increases the risk of arterial thrombotic events, so to a very modest degree. We know a little bit about risk factors in that the risk seemed to be preferentially borne out by patients who were over the age of 65 or who had had previous arterial thrombotic events, particularly previous or recent MIs or previous TIAs or previous strokes, which is perhaps not surprising. If you're older and you've done it before, you're at greater risk of doing it again. But that's what we know. Now, if you look at the different disease trials, there actually seem to be less of a risk in the breast cancer trials than in some of the other trials. I suspect that's because our patients in our randomized trials tended to be a bit younger and a bit healthier than the patients who enrolled in some of the lung cancer trials or the colon cancer trials. But we certainly couldn't say that that risk was not seen in the breast cancer trials as well.
What about cardiomyopathy and bevacizumab?
So there are no reports of cardiomyopathy or congestive heart failure with bevacizumab in any of the trials that either did not give concurrent anthracyclines or were in patient populations who would not have been previously treated with anthracyclines. So this is really an issue specific to breast cancer, sarcomas, and leukemias where anthracyclines are used. The first indication of a potential issue actually came from our monotherapy trial in breast cancer patients. Two of those 75 patients had severe congestive heart failure, but they had both had previous anthracycline. They had both had previous left chest wall radiation. And one of them had progressive metastatic disease with pleural and pericardial involvement at the time of her symptoms. So it was a question, but impossible to know what the contribution of bevacizumab might have been.
So we don't know whether it's even related to it, or conceivably it might be a trastuzumab, maybe repair type thing?
I suspect it's probably the latter, but we don't have nearly enough data. In the randomized capecitabine trial, there were two patients with congestive heart failure in the capecitabine alone group, compared to seven in the capecitabine with bevacizumab group. Now, that sounds like there's an increase, but the overall event rate was so low that statistically those numbers were not different. In the E2100 trial, we didn't see any signal of congestive heart failure comparing the two groups. And in Sandy Swain's 21-patient experience, which is the only breast cancer trial that has given anthracyclines and bevacizumab concurrently, none of those patients had clinical congestive heart failure, but two of them had a decrease in their ejection fraction to less than 40%. And that's all we have from our breast cancer trials. There are two other small trials that have used bevacizumab concurrently with anthracyclines. One in patients with sarcoma that gave them 75 milligrams per meter squared of doxorubicin with each dose, and one with mitoxantrone in patients with refractory AML. And both of those trials had rates of clinical congestive heart failure that were over 10%, with about a quarter of the patients either having clinical symptoms or a decrease in their ejection fraction to something less than normal. And that's exactly why we're doing the adjuvant pilot trial, is that's the extent of our knowledge of combining bevacizumab with anthracyclines at this point. And it's enough to raise the question, but not enough to tell you if this is really prohibitive and should we design the trial to not give them concurrently. And not enough to let you design a rational monitoring strategy for a 5,000-patient trial without committing everybody to sequential cardiac monitoring for more than a year.
As far as I know, there's no actual launched phase 3 adjuvant study right now in the world. Is that true?
There certainly isn't in breast cancer.
What other pilot studies are going on?
The other pilot study that I'm aware of is actually one that we're doing in collaboration with Dana-Farber and UCSF that will also give us some safety data. It is not giving bevacizumab concurrently with chemotherapy, but is looking at giving bevacizumab to patients who received neoadjuvant chemotherapy and still have substantial residual disease at the time of surgery. So that's a group that we know has markedly high risk of ultimately having a distant disease. And it will look at two cohorts. One cohort will get bevacizumab alone for a total of a year, and the other will get bevacizumab for a year with the metronomic Cytoxan and methotrexate regimen added for 6 months. And that trial is both designed to look at safety and tolerability, and it has a large number of potential surrogate markers that we also hope will help us in our search to try and be able to identify which patients might really benefit from this therapy.
So that's the same regimen that Hal Burstein just reported in San Antonio in the metastatic setting?
It's exactly the same regimen. So the first cohort will get bevacizumab monotherapy, and we're certainly not expecting safety issues, but assuming there are no safety problems, a second cohort will receive the combination.
So I'm imagining an oncologist who got up this morning and is taking a long, long drive, who popped the CD into the car. I have no idea if anybody's still there, but all right, now let's get to the practical implications of E2100. What do you think it means? I mean, we have the issue of FDA approval, reimbursement, cost, but just sort of putting that aside, although I don't know if we really can, what do you think this means in terms of clinical decision making?
My answer is pretty simple. Aside from issues of cost and can they find access to the drug, I think for patients who would have been eligible for E2100, that is someone receiving their first chemotherapy regimen for metastatic disease, who has not had an adjuvant taxane within the last 12 months, I would strongly recommend treating them with the E2100 regimen. There is no regimen that has been shown to have the same improvement in progression-free survival with the lack of toxicity that we saw in that regimen. And there are many patients still being treated on the E2100 trial who are now out more than 2 years without progression. So I find that data compelling and hard to ignore. I think the other thing that makes me say that so strongly is that we have data using bevacizumab in more refractory patients, and you don't get the same benefit. So this is not something where you can say, we're going to hold this in reserve, we'll try something else first, and if this doesn't work, then I'll add bevacizumab. That makes no more sense to me than saying that about trastuzumab. Yes, you can get some benefit by using it later, but not nearly the same amount as using it with the first therapy.
What about the patient who you don't want to use a taxane in? Maybe they've got diabetes or neuropathy, et cetera.
If there is someone who otherwise meets the E2100 criteria but has some specific contraindication to a taxane, I would feel comfortable using one of the regimens that we have some safety and efficacy data for. That certainly would include the capecitabine data from our previous randomized trial. There is data with vinorelbine from a phase 2 trial done at the Dana-Farber. There is data from a small phase 2 trial with docetaxel if their problem is specifically with a paclitaxel-related toxicity. And there certainly are data in other diseases, though it doesn't particularly get you more options for breast cancer.
What about the Cytoxan methotrexate metronomic thing?
I have done that.
In the first-line setting?
Absolutely. And I should probably quit now because everyone I've done it in has responded to, so I'm probably headed for a string of patients who won't respond.
How many patients?
4 so far. So I think that would be another very reasonable option. It wouldn't be my first choice for most of those patients just simply because we have such limited data without a randomized comparison. But I think for those patients who have contraindications to taxanes, who are adamant that they don't want IV chemotherapy, who are adamant that they don't want alopecia, that would certainly be a very reasonable option for those patients.
What about patients who've had adjuvant taxanes within the last year?
I'll give you 2 answers to that. Any of the non-taxane regimens for which there is safety data, I think, would be reasonable. Though I think the expectations for those patients should not be particularly great. Those patients were actually allowed to enroll in the capecitabine trial. If you had had an anthracycline and taxane-containing adjuvant regimen and progressed within 12 months, you could enroll in that trial, the capecitabine with or without bevacizumab trial, as your first metastatic therapy. About 15% of the patients in the trial actually were in that group of patients. They did miserably, and they did miserably with both therapies. There was still a slight increase in response rates.
I mean, people who relapse that fast in general don't do too well.
They do terribly, and you can slightly increase their response rates by adding bevacizumab from the capecitabine experience, so the difference is less. The response rates are even less than we reported in that trial, and the progression-free survival is even shorter. So it's certainly worth a try, but I think people need to realize that those are patients who have very aggressive refractory disease. And if there is some other investigational approach available to them, I would feel quite comfortable recommending that they try something even more novel if it was available.
Are there any situations where you think it might be justifiable in a non-protocol setting to continue bevacizumab on progression and switch chemotherapies? For example, a patient who had a great response for a long time?
No. Whether there would be benefit in that setting, we truly don't know. We have no clinical data and we have no laboratory data. that addresses that question at any level. I think it's a critically important question that needs to be studied, both for what it might tell us about biology as well as the practical and financial implications that it has for all of our patients. But outside of a protocol setting, I wouldn't do it.
The only other thing, I don't even know whether to bring it up or not, because, you know, it's just like we can talk about this all night, which is the cost issues, the financial issues. I was at a meeting recently with a very well-known breast cancer investigator, made a comment that drew a pretty decent smattering of applause about the issue of societal cost of some of the new therapies. What are your thoughts about that?
I've actually spent a lot of time thinking about that. And I come to different conclusions if I'm thinking from more of a public policy perspective where I'm thinking about what's best for my patients. It still is interesting to me that I don't remember those same comments being voiced nearly as frequently with the trastuzumab data, which found similar benefit and has similar cost associated with it. And I'm not sure I understand the difference in response to otherwise fairly similar data. Now, the total societal cost would be much greater with bevacizumab because this data applies to a much larger proportion of our population, and perhaps that accounts for it. My most recurring thought about this is that it is easy and simple to calculate the cost of the drug, but the costs that that drug saves you are very difficult to put together, and some you can't put a number to. For some women, this is a huge difference in the amount of time that they are without symptoms of their metastatic disease and are at home with their families and at work and actively participating and contributing to our society. And death from breast cancer is not cheap. It's not cheap in terms of the other therapies that we give patients, and it is definitely not cheap in terms of what we as a society lose by losing those women and what they might have contributed to their families and to all of us. But those are much more abstract concepts that are hard to put a cost on, to try and compare to a simple drug cost where you can call up any pharmacy and find out what a dose of bevacizumab for a particular size patient would cost. I don't think it means that those other costs are less important or that we shouldn't struggle with these issues and where we as a society might get the biggest impact by putting our limited healthcare dollars. But I do worry that the costs that are easy to measure might not be the most important, or certainly are not the only part of the equation that we need to consider.
Neil Maripol makes the point that I thought was very interesting, which is it kind of depends who you ask. And if you ask public policy people or politicians, it's one thing. You ask physicians, it's another thing. You ask patients, it might be something different, which I'm not sure we really have. I guess if you ask the public, who I think has a lot of concerns about cancer in general, you might get a different answer. I'd like to see all those perspectives out on the table before we kind of come to a conclusion about this.
I think you need all of those perspectives. I think you need a better sense of the long-term benefits. I certainly know of patients treated on E2100 who have stopped the paclitaxel long ago. They're still on bevacizumab. It's now 2.5 years and they're not progressing and they are working full-time. They're taking care of their families. All of those things that have economic impact for their families and our society, but they're very difficult to measure. And to put a dollar figure on those, to then compare that dollar figure to the cost of bevacizumab.
All right. Well, we never got to any other subject. Now, it's funny. This morning, I started out with Mark Pegram talking about adjuvant trastuzumab. And, you know, hour and a half later, we're still on adjuvant trastuzumab. And now with you, an hour and a half later, we're still on bevacizumab. I mean, it's just mind-boggling the amount of information that's out there that oncologists need to consume right now.
It's huge. I truly don't know how people in practice who need to try and stay up to date on multiple diseases are able to do that, because the field is progressing so rapidly, and I think in such an exciting direction, but it's one where you really need to understand the biology behind the therapy to be able to use the therapy in the best way, which I don't think you could say about chemotherapy. You know, I don't think you needed to understand much about renal physiology to safely give people cisplatin and to know how to manage its toxicities. I'm not sure that's true for some of our newer therapies.